Good evening, everyone. How's everybody doing? Excellent. Excellent, excellent. Is anybody here who is here, was not here in the previous sessions? Anybody, is this your first time here for this particular thing? Okay, excellent. Anybody, is this your first time here at Kadampa Center ever? Okay, a couple people. Excellent. I actually remembered this time to bring my little handouts that I mentioned last time. So if you're interested and anybody who wants to on your way out this evening, if you want, there's a little set of handouts on that table over there. It says Meditation 101 Introduction Handout or something like that. They're on that table, this little white single sheets. You're welcome to take one of those. It gives, hello, welcome, welcome. Have you guys been here before for these? You are? Okay, great. Welcome back. So yeah, the little white handouts give you some information about Kadampa Center and our, some of the background information that I went over in session one that I am, I don't go over the same thing each time, but you can read some of the basic information about Kadampa Center and about our resident teacher, Geshe Gelick, and about Meditation 101 in general on that little white sheet if you want. Session three ready. Awesome. So I think it's always nice to take a moment to introduce ourselves or to say hello if you're sitting next to the same person you were before, if you're sitting next to someone new that you haven't met yet. Just everybody take a moment and say hello. All right. Well, my name is Scott, and I'm going to be leading the class tonight. For those of you who are here for the first time, we're not super formal here, so if you need to get up and use the restroom, please do that right out through the door to the left. Men's room and ladies' room are right there. You're welcome to bring something to drink if you like, and or if you need to get up, I think we have a water fountain out here somewhere in the front. I ask everybody to please, I put my cell phone on airplane mode so it like doesn't ring or make any noises at all for this. So if you would just make sure your phone is going to meditate for the next hour and a half. And that's really helpful. If you do have, like, if you have, you know, sick kid at home or something, you're like, I really have to take this text or this call if it comes, that's fine. But otherwise, it's nice to just be able to concentrate on being here. Let's see. So we're going to start by doing a short meditation. And for the people who haven't been here before, if you're sitting in a – the most important thing is to sit comfortably when we're meditating. Some people sit on a cushion. If that's comfortable for you, then great. If you're more comfortable sitting in a chair, then sit in a chair. There's really not a right or a wrong when it comes to that, except if you're really super uncomfortable, then you're not really doing it right. So if you're sitting on a cushion, if you're sitting in a chair, it's nice to have either your feet, if your feet naturally rest flat on the ground, that's great. If your feet don't rest flat on the ground, it's nice to have a cushion. That's why we have the cushions around here. Set your feet on a cushion so that they do rest on something. If you're sitting on a cushion and just a comfortable cross-legged position, again, whatever's comfortable. Some people sit in a half lotus position where you have one foot up on your leg. And if you've been doing this for a while and you can do it with both legs, then full lotus is both feet up on your legs. This is not really, you know, probably not everybody's cup of tea, and don't like hurt your knees or anything trying to do this. You don't have to do this. The only reason I do it is to keep my legs from falling asleep. But if it's not comfortable, then again, there's probably no reason to. Main thing is to be comfortable. And the most important thing, does anybody remember? I've said it a couple times. The most important thing when you're meditating, straight back, exactly. Yep. So however you're sitting, in a chair or on the floor, have your back straight. And you shouldn't feel like really stiff and rigid, but just upright. Like think about, imagine you're having your picture taken. You know, and you want to sit up straight and smile. Sometimes it helps to think of if you're like a puppet, you have a little string lifting you up from the top of your head. So back straight is really important. We'll just go briefly over the 7-point meditation posture, which we talked about. So again, the first point is your legs and whatever's comfortable for you. You know, really sitting in a position that's comfortable is most important. One of our resident nuns who used to be here, her knee bothered her a lot. And she would just sit cross-legged with a cushion under one of her knees because that was the most comfortable. If you want a cushion under both knees, we have plenty of cushions. So do whatever's comfortable. Your arms, in this tradition, we have our hands, palms facing upward, right hand resting in the left hand, and your palms just resting comfortably in your lap. If you have your thumbs touching, and imagine you're just like holding a piece of paper between your thumbs, just your thumbs gently touching. You can also have your hands resting on your knees, but this is normally the way we do it. Again, having your back straight is most important. Shoulders back slightly, not really stiff and rigid, but imagine you're trying to look good, like you're getting your picture taken. Feeling very supported by your back. Some people find it easier. The fourth point. First point is legs, second point is arms, third point is back. Also with your arms, if you can, have your arms away from your body a little bit. Let a little bit of air circulate. That tends to be more comfortable. The fourth point is your eyes. So your eyes, if it's easier for you to focus on the meditation with your eyes closed than have your eyes closed, it can be nice to have your eyes just slightly open. Not so you're really focusing on anything, but just enough to let a little bit of light in. And your gaze should be directed just kind of naturally about 6 feet out in front of you. Just kind of naturally directed towards the floor about 6 feet out in front of you. The fifth point is your jaw and mouth. So if have your lips together, just lightly touching, and your jaw relaxed. So don't have your teeth clenched, just have your jaw relaxed. If your teeth are open slightly, that's fine. The sixth point is your tongue, and it helps to have the tip of your tongue just lightly touching the roof of your mouth right behind your front teeth, and that helps reduce the need to swallow. And your head, if you think about your head, just moving your head up and down slightly, think about having your head in a position that it naturally directs your gaze like about 6 feet out in front of you. So, not staring down at the ground right in front of your knees and not, looking way up into the sky. You might find if your mind is really busy and really scattered, sometimes it helps to lower your head a little bit. If you find that you're like on the verge of falling asleep, it might help to lift your head a little bit. So you can experiment with moving the position of your head a little bit depending on what you need and what your mind's doing. So that's the 7-point meditation posture. The next thing we're going to do is the 9-round breathing meditation. Does anybody remember that from last week? Okay. So the purpose of this is to eliminate what we say waste energy in the body. And if that seems like a little strange, like waste energy, what do you mean waste energy? Just think about it as maybe a way of reducing stress, like eliminating stress from your body. And so to start the 9-round breathing, you take your left hand and take the ring finger of your left hand, and you're going to block your left nostril, and you're going to breathe in through your right nostril. Nice, long, slow, deep breath in through your right nostril. And then you're going to block the right nostril and long, slow, deep breath out through the left nostril. So blocking the left nostril first and breathing in, blocking the right nostril, breathing out. Go ahead, we'll go ahead and do that one time. That's one. Then do that two more times, breathing in through the right nostril, out through the left, two more times. So once you've done that, then you take the right hand and block the right nostril. Long, slow breath in through the other nostril. And then take the right hand and block the left nostril. Long, slow breath out. And then do that two more times. And then just take three long, slow breaths through both nostrils to finish it off. So that's 9-round breathing to eliminate waste energy is the full name of the meditation. 9-round breathing to eliminate waste energy. And it's just a nice way to settle your mind at the beginning of a meditation session. It's usually what I do at the beginning of a meditation session is just 9-round breathing. So now that we've calmed our minds down a little bit, sit and just breathe naturally. Just pay attention to your breath for a few moments as you breathe naturally in and out through your nose. Not forcing yourself to breathe any certain way, just allowing the breath to pass, just watching it as it passes in and out. Take a moment to notice anything going on in the room around you, any sounds, any feelings. Are you uncomfortable? Are you comfortable? Is it warm? Is it cool? You might notice sounds outside. Maybe sounds here in the room. Just notice. Don't let it carry your attention away, just noticing. And then bring your attention back to your breath. And just observe your breath. So it's always useful to create an altruistic motivation for a meditation session. Think that you're meditating not just for your own individual benefit, but you're taking the time now to meditate and develop your mind to become a wiser and kinder person. And that will allow you to benefit all beings. So we're going to practice for a few moments the bare attention meditation that we did, which is where you're just focusing on your breath, bringing your attention to the tip of your nose where your breath passes out and in. And pay attention to the sensations right at the tip of your nose as you breathe out and then breathe in again. You might notice warmer sensations as you breathe out, cooler sensations as you breathe in. You might notice the movement of the small hairs at your nose. your nostrils. So focus on those sensations, the sensations of the breath passing out and in right at the tip of your nose. Loosen your concentration slightly and emphasize the element of mindfulness in your meditation a little more strongly. Mindfulness is the quality of observing as you meditate, noticing if you are focusing on your breath or if your mind has become distracted, if you find yourself momentarily paying attention to a sound or a thought. It's that element of your meditation, of noticing. So let that become a little more strong. Allow your mind to be attentive and observant of whatever comes to notice, regardless of what it is. Don't identify with mental elements that arise. You're just observing them like a tourist. Allow them to arise as you observe them and then pass away without you getting involved. Just being aware of whatever's going on in your mind as you sit, noticing the passage of your breath. Allow your mindful attention to expand and to encompass your entire sphere of experience, your entire sphere of consciousness. Forget that there's an observer and something being observed. Simply imagine your experience, your consciousness, as being like the sky, completely clear and vast and spacious, without end. Concentrate on this experience and identify with this experience of calm, clear, spacious awareness. The mind can be compared to an ocean, and the thoughts and other mental elements and other mental events to fish swimming through that clear, spacious medium. Ordinarily, we're unaware of the nature of the mind, and instead we observe only the fish-like thoughts. It's as though we're observing an aquarium through a large glass wall, and at first we only notice the fish. If someone were to tell us to observe the clear water in which the fish were swimming, we might at first have difficulty noticing it because of its transparency. But by simply realizing that the fish could not be swimming unless there was some substance to swim in, we can take our attention away from observing the fish and focus instead on the clear water. In a similar fashion, we let go of paying attention to our fish-like thoughts. Instead, we step back and recognize the clear, light nature of our mind, within which all of our thoughts and other mental events occur. We identify with our minds like an ocean. We identify with that clear, vast spaciousness. In an ordinary state of mind, as we go about our business every day, having conversations, planning, thinking, worrying, making lists, and so on, it's as if we're living on the surface of the ocean. All those thoughts and feelings and ideas seem to fill our minds, making lots of waves and lots of turbulence. But as we identify more and more with our ocean-like mind and let go of the wave-like emotions and fish-like thoughts. It's as if we start to descend to the quiet depths of that ocean-like mind. We reach a state of mind that is more peaceful, still, free of agitation and disturbance. In the case of the aquarium, we'll continue to see the fish swimming in front of us as we focus on the water. However, when we focus our attention on the clear, light nature of the mind, our thoughts will begin to diminish in intensity and frequency, thereby quieting the mind and enhancing our ability to concentrate. When we can simply observe our thoughts and feelings arising without getting involved, when we can identify with the ocean instead of the fish-like thoughts and the wave-like emotions, then we can reside in that spacious purity of our basic clarity of mind. Calm, clear, peaceful, open spaciousness. Without agitation, without delusions, without anxiety and distress, without dissatisfaction, attachments, and aversions. For the last few moments of the meditation, just focus on that clear spaciousness of mind, the clear, vast spaciousness of mind, like an ocean. And now take a moment to dedicate all the positive energy you've created through the practice of mindful meditation to becoming a better and better person who is more at peace in life and who can bring more peace and well-being to others in every moment of every day. And when you're ready, bring your attention back to the room. That was a little bit of a long session. If you want to get up and move around a little bit, please do. Get some blood flowing back in your legs. And for the people who are just joining us for the first time tonight, we record all these sessions, and if you go on to our website, kadampa-center.org, you can download the recordings from the last few weeks, the last 2 weeks, this is session 3. So you'll find them on there, Meditation 101, for the last two Tuesdays, and you can just download those and listen to them if you want to get caught up on what we've been discussing. So does anybody give a mic, Chris? Awesome. Does anybody have any observations? How many people had a chance to try at least a few days of meditation, a few meditation sessions this week? Okay, tried it at least a few times. Did anybody do it every day? Okay. I'm not going to raise my hand because I didn't. How's it going? Anybody have any interesting experiences that they'd like to share? Any challenges? Anything you found difficult while you were trying to practice this? Anything that you found helpful? Anybody? Yeah? Or? Yes. We'll use the microphone.
Well, I think it's a little helpful for me to do it in the morning as opposed to the evening. I've discovered that, and to try to do it at a set time every morning to just develop a routine with it has been helpful for me.
Good. Excellent. Yeah. That's what the teachers recommend. They generally say do it in the morning and try to do it at the same time. So I guess it works. Anybody else have anything they want to share? Anybody have any questions? Questions about anything we discussed in the last few sessions, questions that came up during the week? Everybody pretty good? Okay. What do you think about, so the meditation that we just did, the mind like the ocean, is very similar to the meditation on the mind like the sky, where you're trying to focus on, you know, we're always focusing on our thoughts. We're always paying attention to our thoughts, the different thoughts that go zooming by in our brains, you know, all day long. And we don't necessarily pay as much attention to the mind itself, or we don't even necessarily think of the mind as something separate from our thoughts. You know, I think we tend to think of them very easily as intertwined, or they're just the same thing. You know, what's my mind? Oh, it's my thoughts. You know? But what do you think about these exercises of actually trying to see your mind as separate from your thoughts? That your mind is like this medium, this clear, spacious medium, and the thoughts are just things that pass by in it. Anybody have any thoughts about that? I see a lot of people nodding, so maybe it's just at least interesting to do. It is interesting to think about these things in a different way than we normally do, than we're used to thinking about them. What do you think is the benefit of doing that? We talked a little bit about some, but maybe, you know, in your own words or your own ideas about the benefits of doing these types of meditations, trying to observe your thoughts and observe the way they pass by rather than just zoom, there they go. Yeah.
Thank you. So taking into consideration that we're having like stressful lives, at least I do, it makes it much, much easier for me to actually like rationalize the stress, where the stress is actually coming from, and like separate the thoughts, the good thoughts and the bad thoughts, and it's just like this just takes the stress away. So for me, meditation is just a way to relieve my stress.
Good. So. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Yeah, in the back.
Well, if I'm having a good day, I can feel a little less attached to my thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that I don't have to react to them, that I don't have to do anything about them, that they don't really mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just be like, it's just a mechanism that just keeps going on and on.
Mm-hmm.
I can just let that go by.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a good day.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, this is one of those things that does require practice. You know, it just, it does, and it's going to, some days are going to be really good. Some days you're going to sit down in the morning at your meditation time, and you're going to sit there for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 or however long you do, and it's going to be great. And you're going to think, wow, I got it. And then the next day you're going to sit down and your mind's going everywhere. So it is practice, right? That's why we call it practice, because it takes time and doing it repeatedly to really get, you know, to make it work the way you want to. So that's an important thing to remember. Yeah, did you have
I felt like my perception of time seems completely different.
Yeah,
like 15 minutes seems like it's really fast.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, and then I tried doing it again and again. It just felt completely different.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you're just about to fall asleep,
mm-hmm.
and you feel like that's 10 minutes. It mm-hmm. didn't seem like 10 minutes at all. It felt like an hour. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I've had the same experience. Sometimes it seems to go by really fast, sometimes really slow. I think it's interesting. Our perception of time definitely, I think, well, I won't say hour, my perception of time can change a lot depending on what I'm doing. You know, some weeks seem to go by really fast, and sometimes it's Friday and I'm going, was that just Monday when that happened? It seems like 2 months ago. So it's interesting to notice that. And again, that's all from noticing our thoughts, right? Taking some time to notice our thoughts and some of the things that we just do automatically. It's a little interesting when we think about them a little more consciously. But that is the idea, like you said, the idea of not reacting, like realizing that you do have a little bit of a choice. It's not easy. You have to practice. We do naturally tend to react to whatever thoughts we have. But if you start getting a little bit of space, a little bit of separation between the thought occurring and just automatically thinking that, oh, I just have to react to whatever thought comes. You know, maybe after you have a thought and react to it, maybe you think back and go, no, you know, maybe I didn't really necessarily need to react that way. And then after that happens maybe 4 or 5 or 500 more times, maybe once you catch yourself before you react, right, and then you actually do something instead of reacting, or change the way you react in a way that you think is going to be more beneficial. So that's really what we're trying to do. I don't know what, you know, Geshe Gelug, does anybody come on Sunday and see Geshe Gelug, our teacher? Okay. So one of the things he says, and I don't remember what text this is from, but the purpose of meditation is to reduce disturbing thoughts. That's one of the lines from a certain text on meditation that he quotes. That's really what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to notice and kind of get a little separation from the thoughts that we find disturbing and be a little more objective and rational in the way we observe them. You know, and maybe improve our ability to just let them pass. You know, they're going to come. You know, we're going to have disturbing thoughts from time to time, but maybe we get a little better at just letting them pass by without chasing after them or letting them run the show. So we talked a couple of times about the Tibetan word for meditation, which is gom, and in English it means familiarization. Basically, that's like the literal translation. So the purpose in this tradition, the purpose, what we're trying to accomplish with meditation is to become more familiar. And we're trying to become more familiar with our minds and the way they work, and we're trying to become more familiar with virtuous states of mind that lead to happiness. Understanding our minds better. And we talked last week about how the mind is viewed in Tibetan Buddhist philosophy. Does anybody remember specifically things that we said about the Tibetan Buddhist philosophy of the mind and how it works? If you just want to say something, I'll repeat it so everybody can hear. Does anybody remember anything come to mind when we were talking about that? Anything you remember? How Tibetan Buddhists view the mind? Yeah. Separate from the brain, that brain and mind are two different things. Mind, we often, a synonym is consciousness, right? What we think of as consciousness, the fact that I'm sitting here in a room seeing a bunch of people and I'm hearing sounds and all the things that I'm aware of, that kind of, you know, each individual thing like sight and sound and, you know, touch and temperature, that's considered an element of consciousness. And then just, you know, consciousness itself, being aware itself. And that's considered separate from the brain in this philosophy. Yeah. Anything else? Anybody remember? Anybody remember there were two ways that we described? So if the mind isn't the brain, then what is it? Right? If consciousness, mind, is not the brain, and it's not directly like a product of the brain, then what is it? Yeah, so that's the idea. The brain is a physical organ, and the mind is, or consciousness is non-physical. It's a non-physical phenomenon. You can't touch it, right? So that's one of the characteristics of mind. We talk about two characteristics of mind. And one of them is clear, which refers to it being non-physical. It has no shape. It has no color. It has no size. You can't touch it. You can't, like, you know, look on a scan of your head anywhere and say, yep, that's my mind. It's non-physical. So that was what we mean by clear. And then we say it's knowing. Right? The mind is clear and knowing. So the function of the brain is to cognize, to know, to have thoughts, to be aware. That's the function of the brain. So one of the things we don't tend to do in this particular tradition, which you may do in other, and if you've done this in a different type of meditation or another class, that's great, you know. But what we don't tend to do in this tradition is try to not think of anything. Just try to sit there and don't think of anything. you know, you probably have heard the example of that. Like, don't think about a pink elephant, right? Do not, whatever you do, do not think about a big, cute, pink elephant sitting right here in the room. It's kind of hard to not think of something. But what we are trying to do is to learn concentration and improve our ability to concentrate so that we can choose what we focus on, choose what our mind is, you know, paying attention to, what our mind is knowing and aware of at a certain time. So the mind is awareness. That's one thing that they say, and I'm not sure if I totally, you know, could explain this very well in my own words, but what they say is, like, the mind does not have awareness. The mind is awareness. Mind is awareness. So just by means of definition. The mind is also viewed as changeable and impermanent. And impermanent, in this, the way we use the term means, it just means it's changing, it changes. It's not fixed, it's not always the same. So when we say something is impermanent, then it is changing and it's capable of changing. The mind is viewed as impermanent, right? And this is kind of in line with, and it's been a change, you know, if you were to go back a certain, you know, a few decades and you were to talk to a, you know, psychologist or neuroscientist about the mind and or the brain, they would say, oh, yes, the brain is very fixed. You know, after a certain age, you kind of just have whatever you got, and then that's what you have for the rest of your life, you know. And there were certain ideas about, you know, not being able to learn language and not being able to learn certain things after a certain age. But now, I think these days, if you were to go to talk to a neuroscientist, they would talk about neuroplasticity and the idea, even in the modern scientific view, that the brain is constantly changing throughout your life. You're constantly making new connections, building new connections in different parts of the brain. And, you know, it's a little different view than there was at one time. But you know, the Buddhist view has always been that the mind is changeable. That it is always changing, whether we, you know, accept that or not, or want to or not. Our minds are always changing. Every experience that we have, everything that we do is always affecting our minds and causing it to change. And we have the ability to direct that. If we want to change our minds in a more positive way, if we have habits of mind that we're not really finding very helpful, that we have the ability to change them. And so meditation is part of that. And so we say, like, the mind is comparable to the ocean. The mind is the ocean, and then thoughts, you can kind of think of them as, like, I kind of like the way they say it in that meditation that we just did, that the thoughts are kind of like the fish swimming through the ocean, and the emotions are like waves rising and falling on the ocean. So those things are there, and they're part of the whole shebang, right, the whole phenomena of mind, but they're not the mind. The thoughts themselves are not the mind. The feelings are not the mind. The mind is different from that. So when we talk about, like, the making a motivation at the beginning of a meditation or dedication at the end of the meditation, you may have heard me say, you know, you think for a moment that all of the merit that you've created, all the positive energy you've created, think of dedicating that to the benefit of all sentient beings. And so sentient being, that term has, you know, sometimes we say all living beings, sometimes we say all sentient being. So that is a very distinct meaning in Buddhism. Sentient being is, the word in Buddhism is semchen, which are the word or phrase, semchen, which is mind holder, mind possessor. And so that's like the word for a living being, you know, for a human or a dog or an insect. Or that crazy green grasshopper that's living in my car now, yeah. So anything that is capable of conscious action is considered to have mind, according to this philosophy. Any living being that's, so plants aren't considered to have mind because we don't really observe them making conscious actions. I mean, plants do kind of grow towards the light. And, you know, plants do certain things, and I think they've even found, like, plants do some, like, chemical communication with each other kind of thing. Mm-hmm. In Buddhist philosophy or in modern scientific? Yeah. So, you know, again, there's definitely divergence between modern, there's similarities, you know, interesting similarities, but there's also some divergence between modern scientific thought and Buddhist philosophy, for sure. So in Buddhist philosophy, they don't believe that plants are sentient. That basically what they're doing is very automatic. It's not conscious. It's not, you know, willful action. It's not action with intention. Whereas anything that makes an action with intention is considered a living being. Or not living being. I guess plants would be considered living beings, but when we say sentient being, mind possessor. Something that is capable of conscious action. And that may change. You know, maybe if scientists are able to prove that plants are capable of conscious action. There's a really interesting, if you ever read the Dalai Lama, if you ever read any of his books, there's one, and I forget which book it is, but he's talking about how basically, you know, Buddhism is very open to new ideas. And he talks about how, you know, if scientists, and this goes back to the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, where he said, you know, you have to look at everything I say. Don't believe it just out of respect for me as a teacher. Shakyamuni Buddha said, look at everything I say and think about it carefully and compare it to your own rational experience. And if you, after careful examination, you know, he talked about examining teachings as if they were gold, like the way someone would, you know, if you were trying to tell, especially back in those days in India 2,000 years ago, I guess, if you were trying to tell if something was real gold, a metalsmith would cut it and burn it and weigh it and do these different tests. And so he talked about, you know, the teachings being like that, that you have to examine them very carefully. And if you find after examining them that they're not true, then you have to reject them. You just kind of set it offhand like that. Like, hey, if you don't, you know, if you examine what I say and what I'm telling you and you find it is not true, then don't believe me. And, you know, the Dalai Lama said the same thing. He was talking about that basic idea. And he said, like, for example, there's a text, you know there's a Buddhist text some Buddhist scholar wrote many, many years ago, centuries ago, where it talks about the distance between the sun and the moon. And scientists have shown the distance is different. Or the distance between the sun and the earth, I think it was. And scientists have shown us that the difference is that distance isn't correct, so we'll just believe the scientists. That's okay. You know, so it's very open to that kind of idea. In fact, if you look at the Tibetan flag, if we have Tibetan flag, you know, I don't think we have any in the Gompa, but like outside. Tibetan flag has, because Tibet is a very strongly Buddhist country, and the Tibetan flag has a yellow border on three sides, which it symbolizes what we call the three jewels in Tibetan philosophy. And then the fourth side is open, and that represents being open to new ideas, to non-Buddhist ideas. So it's kind of a really interesting philosophy that's very deeply ingrained in this, or an idea that's deeply ingrained in the philosophy. So maybe if scientists prove that plants do have take conscious action, then that's change. So that's, again, just kind of a recap of what mind is. But sentient being, you know, semchen, mind possessor, we're all sentient beings. All insects, all animals are considered sentient beings. And the reason that's important is because anything that's considered to have mind is capable of, you know, it's considered that you're capable of developing your mind, capable of improving your mind. Some degree. And being a human is considered, you know, a lot of us say, oh, I wish I was a cat. You know, I mean, look at my cat. My cat lives a great life. Or look at my dog. My dog lives such a great life. A lot of us really think, I mean, how many people think that dogs and cats, a lot of dogs and cats have better lives than most humans? You know, maybe in some ways in this country, yes. You know, we have certainly pets that eat better than people eat in some countries, you know, things like that. But what they would say in this philosophy is that if you really look at the way a dog or a cat behaves, their behavior is very much driven by instinct. You know, they do make conscious decisions, but a lot of what they do is just driven by instinct, and a lot is driven by fear. You know, watch a big bad dog, you know, big Rottweiler or pit bull or something like that in a thunderstorm, a really bad thunderstorm, you know, and goes and dives under the bed. Cats, you know, you have a cat and you shine a little laser pointer or you take the little feather thing that cats love and you go play with that and they go diving at it. And it's a predator response. They want to kill that thing and they can't stop themselves. It's an instinctive hardwired response to kill that light or to kill that little feather. Right? And so, yeah. Oh, yeah, let's do the mic.
Don't you think maybe they're playing, though? Like, we play, you know?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
You know, like, what if they're actually just playing? They know that's not, like, a mosquito or whatever, but it's just, like, a game for them, you know?
Do you think so?
I mean, I don't think my dog thinks that the stuffed animal is a living thing. I mean, they can smell it. I mean,
yeah.
Because they can smell things.
Do you know why dogs like the toys that squeak?
Is it because that's like the noise, the sound that an animal dying would do?
Yeah. So there's a certain amount, you know, I mean, absolutely, animals are aware of, you know, they do make conscious decisions. But if you, like, look at a cat's eyes, watch a cat's eyes when you wave that little feather, or watch a cat's, you know, when you shine the laser, there's a really noticeable change when that predator response kicks in. So again, the idea, and we could sit here all day and talk about dogs and cats and how they're similar and different from us, but there is certainly an idea that very much and you'd probably agree that in certain situations, like the thunderstorm, right, that the dog's afraid of the thunderstorm. I mean, humans have a much better ability to rationalize and understand things. And maybe it takes time. Maybe you know, some people in this room are afraid of thunderstorms. But maybe we've learned over time to be a little more rational about it and not just go diving under the bed or in the closet when the thunderstorm comes, right? It's really hard for a dog or a cat to get to that point, where they're not going to be afraid of things that are. So they are very, very much under the control of fear. And so that's why being a human being is considered such a valuable thing, because we have the ability to, we have two things. We have the ability to, of rational thought, the ability to really think through things and improve our minds that way. But we also have leisure time, especially in a country like this. We have a lot of leisure. It doesn't always feel like it, right? You know, we have school, we have work, and we have family, and we have all these things. But really, in the grand scheme of things, you know, you're not getting up at 6 in the morning to go, well, maybe you are, but I think most of us in this country are not getting up at 6 in the morning and going walking a few miles to go get water and then come back to the house and then walk a couple more miles to the field to go work in the sun all day and then come home and make a meal and basically have just enough energy left to crawl into bed and pass out, you know. A lot of people in a lot of parts of the world, just their entire life is just dedicated to day-to-day survival. So we have a little bit more flexibility in that. We have a little more free time, a little more leisure time to spend in things like meditation. But it's also considered a good thing that we have just enough unhappiness in our life, enough suffering in our life to be motivated to do that, to actually be motivated to improve ourselves. Because if life was just perfect, if you could just snap your fingers and have anything you wanted to, would you be really motivated to change anything? Would you be motivated to, even if it was possible to improve yourself, would you really be motivated to do that? Probably not. So the life that we have, when we talk about being a sentient being, a human life is considered especially valuable for those reasons, that we have the ability to improve ourselves and we have the motivation to do it. So, let's talk a little bit about different types of meditation. So there are two major categories of meditation in Tibetan Buddhism: analytical and stabilizing meditations. So, analytical meditation, we'll start with stabilizing meditation. Stabilizing meditation is kind of like, sometimes you'll hear it, or one version of it, or one type of it, is concentration meditation. So the idea is that you want to, you know, we want to improve our abilities to concentrate, your ability to just focus on one single thing, which is hard, you know. Sit and try to just count your breaths and do nothing except pay attention to the breath moving in and out through your nose and count every breath. You breathe out, you breathe in, you count that as one. You breathe out, you breathe in, you count that as two. And see if you can count to 10. We've tried this in class, right? And how many people said, okay, count to 10? And how many people you kind of realized that you were counting to 30 at some point, right? Have you done that one yet? It's like, okay, count to 10. 25, 26, that's not 10. Wow, it just totally went by there, you know, because your mind was somewhere else. Or you just catch yourself where your mind is somewhere else, right? You say, oh, yeah, thinking about that email or the shopping list or the show I'm going to watch. So it's very difficult for us to focus on one single, like really completely focus our entire minds on one single thing, even something as simple as just counting the breath. It's kind of challenging. So the purpose of a concentration meditation is to improve your ability to do that. And that's what counting the breath is. Or, you know, that would be a concentration meditation, stabilizing meditation. So an analytical meditation would be one like the one that we just did on the mind like the sky. So meditating on, or the mind like the ocean, the one we did earlier today, where you're actually taking a certain concept, a certain idea, like the nature of mind, and analyzing that and thinking about that. So, you know, some of the guided meditations that we do where we're thinking about a certain topic. And there could be analytical meditations where you're thinking about compassion. You know, what does it mean to be compassionate? Meditating on generosity. You know, so you might meditate or analyze, meditate on to analyze a particular quality of mind that you want to develop and think and analyze and think about that to improve your ability to have that quality of mind. What we do in you know, studying Buddhist philosophy is we'll take a certain topic or a certain idea that's been taught and analyze it through meditation. You might, like, we might come in here and Geshe Gelug might give a teaching on a certain topic, some text that was written, you know, by a Buddhist scholar. And there might be a certain topic in there that then we'll sit and meditate on and think about that. Say, well, is this really the way things are or not? You know, is that correct or not? Can I really rationally bring myself to the same conclusion as what's written in that book? So that's what analytical meditations are about. We also talk about objects of meditation. So the different objects of meditation might be the breath. That's one. That's an easy one because it's always with us, right? You know, you're always, if you're not breathing, then you really don't need to meditate anymore, at least not in this form. You know, who knows what happens after this, but as long as we're alive and in this form, we're always going to be breathing. And so, but we're not always conscious of our breath, right? We're not always conscious of how we're breathing or the fact that we're breathing. We're usually focusing on other things. So breathing is natural, but focusing on your breath is not very natural. And that's why, you know, breathing meditations can be really useful, just to sit and focus on your breath. Either just sit and focus on the breath itself, or focus on it and try to count the breaths to give yourself, you know, something else to focus on. And this is very useful for developing concentration. You can also meditate on physical objects. That's what a lot of the, you know, like, people wonder, why, what's all this stuff about? All these pictures and the statues and stuff, and like, what's it all about? And so these are all, one of the things that these are used for is meditation. And it's kind of like it really is a symbolic language. So I'm not really that well versed in this, but if you were to talk to somebody who had really studied the symbolism, they could tell you everything on one of these tankas, everything on one of these paintings, every part of it, the colors, the shapes, the figures, all represent some quality of mind that we're trying to develop. And so what people will do is sit and look at one of these paintings and concentrate on those specific qualities of mind. Or you can use a statue, you know, concentrate on a statue. One of the things that you do in terms of using an object, a physical object, and you could use anything as an object of meditation. You know, if you're Christian and you want to use a statue of Jesus or a photo of Jesus, you could use that, right? If you're not practicing any particular religion and you just want to focus on a flower, some object that you find beautiful, you could do that. And one of the types of meditation that we do on an object is you'll sit and look at the object and study it very, very carefully and try to put all your attention on studying the shape and the form of that object. And then you close your eyes and try to develop a, you know, mental image of that object and see if you can just keep your concentration on that mental image of the object in as much detail as possible. Have as detailed of a mental image of the object as you can. So that would be a meditation on a physical object. And then we can also meditate on concepts. So this would be more of an analytical meditation. Like, so concepts like impermanence. You know, what does impermanent mean? What does it mean when we say our minds are changing all the time? Is that really happening? You know, am I really very different today than I was yesterday? Am I different today than I was 2 weeks ago? You know? So thinking about a concept like that, maybe having a very specific, it might be a line from some text that you read, or maybe, you know, you think, maybe you read something in a science textbook or in a research paper about the nature of the mind. And so you sit and think about that and go, well, is that really, do I really understand that? Can I really wrap my head around that? Can I really, is that match my experience? So that would be what, meditating on a concept would be. And then again, we can also meditate on a particular state of mind that we want to develop, like compassion or wisdom. Although in that case, the state of mind isn't necessarily the object of meditation. The state of mind is that would be more of an analytical meditation. Okay. Any questions about any of that? And again, this is just, you know, for the sake of information, just to provide some background about what we're doing and the different types of meditation that we do. Yeah, Chris.
What did you mean by that? That thing that you just said, I can't remember. The object is not the state of mind.
So the state of mind isn't the object of meditation. So the Holiness Dalai Lama describes this as, so when you're meditating on a particular state of mind that we want to develop, like compassion or wisdom, Dalai Lama describes this as the entity in which you are seeking to transform your consciousness through a process of familiarization. So by analyzing the idea of compassion or wisdom, you know, it's so maybe compassion or wisdom is a concept. You have a conceptual understanding of compassion, or, you know, like a very academic, maybe conceptual idea of compassion. But by analyzing the concept, the idea, or analyzing what's been written or said about, or what you understand about compassion, by analyzing it, that helps you develop the state of mind, which is, you know, it's like red, right? Like, so there's, I look at a flag and I say, okay, to me that flag is red. So there's the color that I'm seeing there, but then there's the idea of red in my mind, right? Or compassion, you know, I could sit here and talk about compassion and what compassion is. The Buddhist definition of compassion, which is to, it's the wish that someone be free from suffering. That's the Buddhist definition of compassion, right? So when I experience compassion, there's not a part of my brain necessarily going, oh, this is the wish for other beings to be free from suffering. It's not that very literal, you know, step-by-step definition that's popping into my mind. It's a feeling of compassion. It's an experience of compassion. So I think that's what, you know, if I remember correctly from reading in more detail, I think that's the difference. Does that explain that at all?
Yeah, I think it almost sounds tantric to me, but let's not go there.
That's a whole different, yeah.
Right.
That I don't know.
It's like you're visualizing what you want to be. No, never mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's like to be able to experience something, you have to think about it in kind of more concrete ways first, right, in more definition ways. Like, this is the definition of compassion. And then you think about that definition, you think about examples, you think about things that people have said about compassion, situations where people have experienced compassion. And the idea is to develop, like, an, you know, that when you see a turtle in the middle of the road, you just pull over and stop and you pick up the turtle, you check for traffic, you pick up the turtle and you put it on the side of the road. Has anybody ever do that? I have friends that do that all the time that love turtles. I've done it a few times myself. But you might do that without ever thinking for a moment that you're being compassionate. Right, you might say, oh, you're maybe during the whole thing, not until somebody later says, oh, that was really compassionate of you to do that. You go, oh, yeah, I guess it was. Right, so there's the idea of the intellectual concept, which is something we can meditate on, and then there's the actual happening in the mind that we might not even, you know, realize that that's what it is. So good question, Chris, and I hope that was a helpful answer. Yeah, did you have a question?
Kind of loud, so I might not need this. Okay, so you were talking about objects of meditation, and we talked about the breath, physical object, and then concepts.
Mm-hmm.
So within the idea of concept as an object, we're using that to develop maybe a certain state of mind.
Yeah.
Is that where we're going?
That's perfect,
with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. I'm here. I'm all the way there. Thank you.
Good, thank you. Yeah, and that's the idea. I know, kind of glad we discussed this, because that really is the idea of doing an analytical meditation and meditating on a concept. If you're meditating on a concept, an idea, or a state of mind that you want to develop, I mean, it's really hard to just say, oh, yeah, I'm going to be more compassionate, right? Well, let's see how that goes next time you're on 40 and somebody cuts you off, right? So it takes practice, right? We have to think about what that means. What is it? What does it mean? What are some examples? What are some ways that we want to express that? And by analyzing that in our minds, we can actually develop the experience of it where it actually does happen. So, yeah, that's kind of what it's about. All right, so next thing we'll talk about is obstacles to meditation. So again, this is just going into a little more detail about the ideas of meditation and what it is and how it works and, you know, a little bit more of the nuts and bolts of it. It's good to be aware of it. So the two primary obstacles to meditation are drowsiness or dullness and distraction. And I think we were talking about this, you know, I think the first session, some people had questions about this, we were talking about it a little bit. So we also talk about this as sinking mind, so drowsiness or dullness is sinking mind, and distraction is excited mind. You know, distraction is like just when every little thought that comes into your head, you're ready to go chasing after it, right? Like the cat with the laser pointer, right? Every single thought. It seems, and it, you know, I don't know if you've had this experience, you know, if you've tried meditating and it just seems like, wow, I've thought of everything I could possibly think of in these last 15 minutes except for my breath. You know, it's like, which is amazing. I have not spent maybe 2 seconds thinking about my breath. And then, you know, drowsiness or dullness is just when you feel like, you know, maybe like you're falling asleep or like you're drowsy or just sinking. It's almost the opposite feeling, but it's the same effect, as you really have trouble focusing on that object of meditation just because your mind just kind of keeps dropping away from it. You're like, oh, yeah, I'm supposed to be meditating. I'm supposed to be thinking about my breath. So we have antidotes to these things, and there are a number of different antidotes, but one is for drowsiness or dullness, think about your physical posture. So make sure that your back is straight. If you're finding yourself feeling drowsy, make sure your back is straight. You can lift your head slightly, open your eyes more, let in a little bit of light, especially if you have your eyes closed and you're feeling drowsy. You know, that might be a good reason to open your eyes more. You can increase the light in the room. It's another thing. Reflect on something you find joyful. That's another antidote to drowsiness or to sinking mind. If you enjoy riding on a train, think about how much fun it is to ride on a train. Think about a bright color or a bright light. That can also help. And so some of these things are, these antidotes are, you know, you might have to apply repeatedly. Like if you're doing a longer meditation session, some of them might be nice if you're doing like a little 5 or 10 minute meditation and you find yourself feeling a little drowsy, then maybe you think about one of these things for a few moments and, you know, you're back on track. But some of these were also intended for people who were doing much longer, prolonged meditation sessions where, you know, at some point you're going to experience this, you know, this sinking mind. And so you have different antidotes that you apply. The antidotes to distraction are you can focus on the breath to calm the mind. So it may be like you're doing an analytical meditation. Maybe you're thinking about some aspect of mind. Maybe you're thinking about compassion. And you just find you have a hard time concentrating on that thing you're supposed to. So you take a few moments and focus on the breath. You know, focus on the count your breath or focus on the breath to calm your mind. Again, think about your physical posture. You might lower your head slightly, close your eyes a little bit if you're feeling distracted. If you feel like you have a very excited mind, close your eyes slightly. Decrease the light in the room. So this is an interesting one, too. Reflect on a sobering subject, such as suffering, or think about something you don't know. And I thought this was really interesting. I think I was doing a meditation like workshop or retreat that we were doing with Geshe Gelug, and he said this is an antidote to distraction. Think about something that you don't know, that you don't understand. Like, oh yeah, I really don't know how to do that certain type of math equation, you know, I'm not really good at trigonometry, you know, or I just don't really know that, I don't know how to do that, or, you know, I don't know how many grains of sand there are on Daytona Beach, you know. So thinking about something that you don't know can be an antidote to a distracted mind. So try that sometime if you find yourself really distracted. If you're visualizing an object, if you're meditating on an object, like sometimes you might meditate on a statue or a painting, a tanka, or just a flower or something, imagine that it's very heavy. Imagine that object as being very heavy or that it's very small and you have to look very closely to concentrate on it. That can be an antidote to a distracted mind. So, and these are things that we do, like the antidotes are things that we would do temporarily if you were in a meditation session and you find that you're having trouble because your mind's distracted or because your mind's sinking. You can take a few moments to do this, to apply one of these antidotes, and then resume your meditation, go back to your meditation. I think it can be helpful to think about maybe one or two of those. You know, it's a pretty long list for each one, but what's one antidote to drowsiness, to sinking mind? Think of a bright color. Yep. What's another one? Increase the light in the room. Yep. Posture. Yep. Raise your head a little bit. What's an antidote to a distracted mind? Think about something you don't know. Yep. Focus on your breath for a few moments. Yep. Reduce the light, kind of the opposite, you know, of the other ones. Reduce the light in the room a little bit. Close your eyes or lower your head slightly. So if you remember a couple of these, and if you are doing a meditation session, you find that you're distracted or that your mind's sinking a little bit, you know, you can try one of those. And that's the difference between concentration and mindfulness. You know, concentration is I'm going to focus on my breath right now. And I'm focusing on my breath, and I'm counting my breath. Mindfulness is the awareness of whether you're doing that or not, or whether maybe, you know, there's the part of your mind that says, oh, you really haven't thought about your breath in the last 5 minutes or so, so maybe you're a little distracted, so let's think about, you know, one of those antidotes for a moment. All right. Any questions about any of that? Okay. So we're going to do a meditation on a little bit longer meditation. So if you need to get up for a moment, move around, stretch, take a minute or so to do that. If you want to change if you've been sitting on a cushion and you're not comfortable, you want to sit on a chair, do that. Or vice versa, if you've been sitting in a chair, you want to try sitting on a cushion. This is going to be a little bit longer, though, so I would say make sure that you're sitting somewhere where you're going to be comfortable for a little while. All right. So just a little introduction to this meditation as you're getting comfortable. We have many habitual patterns embedded in our thinking and our behavior. So by replaying our day's actions in our meditation session and transforming those habitual patterns from a negative to a positive in our imagination, we can gradually change our thinking and our behavior. We can become happier individuals and bring greater happiness and well-being to others through our interactions. If we engage in this practice every time we fall into negative behavior, replaying what we've done and reliving it in the most positive way we can imagine will gradually dismantle our negative patterns and replace them with new positive ways of thinking and behaving. This is a good meditation to practice in the evening at the end of the day. And as I've said earlier, some of these meditations that we practice might really click for you, and you might think, wow, that's a great one. I want to, you know, practice that as much as I can, and that's a good thing to focus on. And others that we practice may or may not, you know, really grab you, and it's okay to just say, yeah, that's not really, you know, what I'm most interested in right now. These handouts, you can download these handouts from our website and have them, and if you want to look back at them sometime and try one that you haven't been trying, so, you know, you can do that. So that's why we try some different ones, just to give you some different experiences, and maybe there's one of them that you do enjoy and you want to start practicing regularly. So we'll do this one. This is transforming negative experiences into positive. So sit comfortably with your back straight. If you have your hands resting in your lap, thumbs gently touching, or hands on your knees, whatever's comfortable for you. Your arms away from your body a little bit. Let a little air circulate. Think about the different points of the meditation posture. Your back, shoulders, your jaw and mouth, your tongue, your eyes, your head sitting in a comfortable position. And let your attention rest on your breath. Focus your attention on your breath. For a minute or two, use one of the breathing meditations, either counting the breaths, the 9-round breathing meditation, if you remember that and you want to do that. or a mindfulness meditation like the bare attention exercise where you just focus on your breathing. Do that to settle your mind into the moment and into a more concentrated state. Sit comfortably and generate the strong intention to do this meditation in order to train your mind to experience difficulties with a calm, clear, and gentle approach. Spend a few moments thinking about your day and the experiences that you've had during the day. Focus especially on difficult situations that may have arisen, situations in which you may have become impatient, lost your temper, seen others as problems or enemies, or perhaps even lashed out at others verbally. Remember that the situation is over and that you're simply experiencing memories now of something that is gone and in the past now. Remembering that, bring a difficult situation to mind. Remember what happened from beginning to end. And watch and observe your mind and your behavior as you replay the situation. Think about the techniques and abilities of mindfulness that we've practiced, and use those to disidentify with the feelings and the actions as much as possible. You're simply watching and observing dispassionately. Think about the disadvantages and harmful nature of the negative responses that took place during that situation. Think about how you felt while being impatient and angry. Did you feel happy? Comfortable? At peace? When that angry feeling led to angry words and actions, What effect did it have on you? What about on others around you? Did it make them happy? Did it make the situation easier? Did the angry behavior help bring the situation to a positive solution? Did it help everyone, yourself and others included, to feel good and understand each other better? Now think about how you might have handled the situation differently with a calm, balanced, and open attitude without anger or impatience or resentment. Think about how your and others' experience of the situation might have been completely different. Generate a strong feeling of how extraordinary it would be to be able to manage difficult situations, just like this one, with a calm and peaceful mind, uncontrolled by anger and agitation. Now replay the entire situation in your mind from beginning to end, imagining it completely differently. Relive the situation and imagine yourself reacting perfectly with warmth and openness toward the other people, with calm and balance and without any anger or agitation. Imagine how the situation might have played itself out in this totally different way. So is the outcome different? How do you feel about yourself at the end of the interchange? Are you pleased or disappointed? What kind of experience do others have in your replay? Is it positive or negative? Make a strong determination that the next time you encounter difficulties that try your patience, you'll take a breath and step back and will try to respond with openness and patience as you did in your meditation, keeping your mind under control and out of the control of anger. In addition, make a strong determination that each time you find yourself responding with impatience, agitation, and anger in the future. You will practice the same meditation in order to gradually overcome those negative response patterns and train the mind to respond with kindness, balance, and patience. So finally, dedicate your positive energy and insights to the well-being and happiness of yourself and all living beings, all sentient beings. So any thoughts about that one?
Yeah.
You see how strange my life is because
I was looking for my book this morning on anger that was written by the Vietnamese Buddhist monk that I can't ever pronounce his name right.
Thich Nhat Hanh.
Thank you. And I couldn't find it. And I was like, I need some guidance on anger today. And then I came here and y'all did this. So I was like, okay, well, message received.
Cool. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
I'm sure Thich Nhat Hanh, a book would be. Well, you'll find it.
I think maybe it got into somebody else's hands that needed it at the time. So
maybe that too.
That does happen.
Yeah.
But I need it back now.
Yeah, his really, some of his books are really wonderful. He read some really great, really great stuff. Anything else? Any other ideas, thoughts? Yeah, Susan.
So this is probably telling a little bit too much about myself, but on the way over here, I had a fight with my daughter because there was no food in the refrigerator. Actually, there was no food that she wanted to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a dialogue back and forth. And basically what she wanted was reassurance from me that I would reimburse her for her dinner if she went out to dinner. But she just kept on yelling at me that we didn't have any food and that it was my fault that we didn't have any food in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept on getting more angry at her because she wasn't listening. And so I think when I replayed everything in my head, I took ownership. I apologized. I did all the things that I don't typically do. And in my head, it all worked out. But at the same time, I thought, well, that's not fair that I took the back seat and I took ownership of everything when half of the discussion is her fault.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, it doesn't really matter who's right or who's wrong as long as there is a consensus that's formed, mm-hmm. I guess. Now, I'm not going to let her step on me all the time,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, sometimes it might be okay to understand where she's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and I think there's an important distinction between making a conscious decision about how you're going to react in a situation. And, you know, it's one of the things they really emphasize because, you know, Buddhism, if you know anything about Buddhism, they place a lot of emphasis on love and compassion and, you know, being kind to others. But also teachers will make a point of saying that doesn't mean that you let yourself be harmed. That doesn't mean that you let somebody, you know, harm you or walk all over you or beat you up or whatever. figuratively or literally. And so, but what we're trying to do here is notice the difference between just reacting, and in whatever way you react, whatever way your mind and your emotions happen to react to the situation, there's a difference between that and making a conscious decision to say, well, this is how I want to handle this. Whatever, you know, now the way that you handle it, that's a totally different conversation. But making a conscious decision about how you want to handle it, whether you just say, yeah, you know, I'll listen to this person, I'll let them vent, and I'll accept that, you know, that's just the way they're going to be, or whether you decide that there's a way you can, you know, approach that person or approach the situation and maybe change their mind about something, right? But there's a difference between making a conscious decision and just reacting, which is mostly what we do, is just react. And it's hard to do in the moment. It's very easy, well, maybe not super easy, it's easier to sit here and analyze a situation that's already happened and think, well, this is how I would do it differently next time. Right? I mean, that's kind of easy. But doing it in the heat of the moment is more difficult. So do you think there's any value in analyzing it afterwards and replaying it and trying and visualizing yourself come to a more positive outcome? Okay, can you give him a mic, Chris?
I think there is, as long as you don't get stuck analyzing it.
Yeah.
Like, over and over and over. Like, mm-hmm. if you analyze it and then come to, like, what you were saying in the meditation where you realize that your behavior, regardless of everyone else's behavior in the situation, just you taking a different tact could have changed the whole situation, the whole outcome of the situation,
mm-hmm.
that you don't have to rely on other people's reactions, that you can actually take that different tact. Mm-hmm. Doing it, like you said, is another, you know, heat of the moment is harder.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that in my case, if I go back over that too many times, that's a negative thing too. Like,
mm-hmm.
if you can continue to say this is in the past and move forward, then I think it's probably helpful to visualize that different outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So that's,
yeah, that's important. I think some people up here had something. Did you have something you wanted to say, sir?
To me, the word analysis is a brain-based, a cortical-based phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about neuroplasticity. So whenever I'm, the one word we haven't used yet is ego, and that's mm-hmm. how I identify brain versus mind,
mm-hmm.
Those repetitive thoughts that plague you.
Mm-hmm.
So analysis for me is a very ego-based and cortical-based process. So whenever I'm trying to reconcile a situation, I acknowledge it instead of analyze it.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helps me come to terms with it. And one thing she said that really spoke to me was from a place of needs.
Mm-hmm.
So her daughter was trying to have her needs met.
Mm-hmm.
And then she ended up forfeiting her needs to meet her daughter's needs to reconcile a situation.
Mm-hmm.
So the situation is just, it's not gotten better, it's just flipped.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, whenever I try and replay or look into the future to make a situation better, I try and do less analysis and more mm-hmm. acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels less forced. It feels like I'm drawing from instead of putting into.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. I think acknowledgement's a slightly different topic from what we're looking at in this meditation, but there is definitely, if you talk about anxiety, you know, like I mentioned in an earlier session, I teach test prep classes for people who are taking standardized tests, graduate level admissions tests. And a lot of people deal with a lot of anxiety on those tests. And there's a difference between the worst thing you can do is try to push it away and say, I'm not nervous, you know, denial, right? Because that doesn't alleviate any of the symptoms. One of the best things you can do is just, you know, reframe it or reappraise it, kind of accept it and just say, yep, this is what's happening, right? Acknowledge it. Like, I think maybe that's similar to what you were saying when you talked about acknowledgement. It's better than, you know, trying to push it away. But what actually, in terms of anxiety, what works best in testing environments is reappraisal to where you view it in a different way. And you say, of course it's normal for me to be nervous, and actually understanding that heightened sense of alertness can be a positive thing in that situation. So yeah, there is an interesting parallel there. And wait, did you have a comment or question?
I was just going to, I think the part about not getting, not overanalyzing it,
mm-hmm.
I found that, I mean, I think you can get into that. I think what helps is, for me anyway, is to only focus on my actions,
mm-hmm.
because you can't control the other person. It's only your actions and interactions that you can control. And also that I don't necessarily think that means that you have to give in just to make peace.
Mm-hmm.
Like there can be another way of going about it and not being the one to give in just to appease and
mm-hmm.
have it not escalate, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. I think that's another aspect or another dimension of it is, you know, I think the first is, and this kind of maybe ties together several of the things that people were saying, is I think we do tend to replay situations in our head. I mean, how many people have done that or caught yourself doing that? Something, like sometimes you have a disagreement with somebody and you just replay it in your head at some point, the next day or later that night, you know, sometimes several times, right? And very often when we're replaying it, it's either just to stew in it a little more. I mean, this is what I've caught myself doing from time to time. Or we're trying to replay it and think about, well, I should have said this, right? I should have told that person totally off, you know, and if this ever happens again, I'm going to say, you know, so we're trying to do it to kind of make, you know, imagine the situation in a way that's better for us, but not necessarily better for anybody else, right? Just make ourselves feel better by thinking we could get the upper hand. That's one of the things. So we do replay situations sometimes in a way that's not very productive. And if like you said, you can download this on off our website if you want. It's on the kadampa-center.org. Go to, you can find that. If you have trouble finding this, let me know. But if you read through this again, it's really about replaying the situation in a way where you are reacting more calmly and more rationally, in a way that you're able to handle the situation better, not just for your own benefit, not to one-up anybody, but in a way that would really be better for everybody. You're more in control, and you can replay it in a way that is, you know, just by, even if nobody else reacts differently, even if, you know, the person you're talking to still loses their temper, by you not doing that, you're not adding fuel to the fire, right? So that's the whole point of the meditation, is to reimagine the situation where you yourself are reacting better and recognizing that on some level that's going to make the situation better. And I think one of the advantages, too, is I would think, I don't know about anybody else, but I would think I could go through a situation like this just once and replay it once this way, and I think I'd be done, right? I don't think this would tend to lead me to, if I'm just picturing my own actions and saying, well, how could I have done better? Okay, yeah, I get it. I could have done better. And I could let it go then, right? I don't think this would have the tendency to need to replay it again and again. So I would see that as a benefit to this. And it really does. You know, it is hard to, it's why we practice things. It's why we practice, and there's so many examples of this. There's an example of this in what I do at work and, you know, things I've done in the past too, but where you practice things in a controlled environment, in kind of a slower speed, you know, than real time, and you practice doing things the way you want. And this is just an example of you're using a situation that because you've already experienced it, it's pretty easy to visualize that situation. It's pretty easy to imagine a situation that just happened earlier today. So by doing that, now you have this kind of clear picture of a situation in your head. You practice doing it or acting in a better way or handling the situation better. And if you do this a number of times, it is preparing you to handle a totally new situation that you've never handled before. So when something does happen, maybe this will pop into your head and you'll say, oh yeah, I know I can do this. I've practiced this. You know, let me try it now in real life and try and see if I can apply some of that. So it really does, I think, possibly if you practice this, prepare you for someday applying it in real time when it's a little bit more difficult than when you have less time to think. That's why you practice it, you know, under more controlled circumstances. And then, yeah, you know, part of what you're analyzing, too, is, you know, how would I react? Like, what is maybe the best way to react? because there are a lot of different ways you can react, and some of them are helping, and some of them are just flipping things over to the other side, you know, taking the, sweeping the stuff under the rug or flipping the beat up old mattress over so, you know, the dents in it are underneath now. So yeah, there's that, you know, how you react is kind of a different story, but you know, you're giving yourself time to think about that too, and just think about a positive reaction. All right, so for your homework, and we'll wrap it up. I've already blabbed a little bit long now, but so continue what you've been practicing during the past week. Continue practicing these meditations we've discussed, and if you want to add something to that, at the end of each day, reflect on your different actions. And we talk about actions of body, speech, and mind. So, you know, there are things you physically do, there are things you say, and then there are things that you just think. And think about, take a moment to think about positive and negative actions. And if you remember doing a negative action and you have want to take a little time and use this meditation on transforming negative experiences into positive, and take a moment to relive the experience and imagine responding positively instead of negatively. So if you remember what we just did, or you know, you get the handout, download the handout and read through it, see if you have a couple chances to apply that during the week. So let's take a moment, do a brief dedication. And you can, you know, kind of do this in your own way, whatever way you think is best. Dedicate some kind of wish to direct the positive energy or thoughts or benefits from this session towards your own benefit and the benefit of other sentient beings. Whatever way makes sense to you or means the most to you. I'll do my usual commercial that I do and say that if you found that this was beneficial and you want to make a donation to help us keep the lights on and pay the mortgage and stuff like that, one of our teachers, Stephanie Steep, used to joke that whoever was leading the class and got the most people to make donations would get a free trip to Hawaii, which it's kind of funny. It's not true at all, but you know, we're volunteers. Chris is a volunteer, or, you know, just about everybody who does stuff here is a volunteer. But if you do want to help out, that's great. If not, that's fine too. But we have donation boxes out there, and you can donate on our website if you care to make a donation to help us keep the center running. Either way, thank you very much for being here. You know, we're really happy that we're able to offer this free of charge. It's all voluntary, whether you donate or not. And we're just happy to have you guys come here and participate. That's the most awesome thing, is just for you guys to be here. So that's my little commercial I'm going to slip in there, too, is come back next week. Keep coming back. We got a couple more weeks to go. This is week three, right? So two more weeks to go. If you didn't get to the earlier sessions, the recordings are on our website. And so hopefully we'll see you all here next week. Thanks for coming. Thanks for being here. Have a good week.